This is an interview with Christopher Taylor for the SEC Historical Society's Virtual Museum and Archive of the History of Financial Regulation. I'm William Thomas, and the date is April 2nd, 2014. I take it you go by Kit Taylor, usually?
Most people know me in the industry as Kit Taylor, yes.
Okay. Well, why don't you tell me a little bit about your personal background before we move into the bulk of your career?
Okay. I have a PhD in economics. I left graduate school, went to work at the Federal Reserve Board, and for a year and a half worked on the savings and loan crisis at the time in 1974-75.
Can we go back and talk a little bit? I guess you're from Pennsylvania.
Oh, yeah. I grew up 40 miles west of Philadelphia, went to a boarding school north of Philly, went to college at Swarthmore College south of Philly. Mm-hmm.
You major in economics?
Economics and mathematics. Oh, and then when I went to Princeton to get my graduate degree in economics, got specialized in, I think the three specialties were econometrics, mathematical economics, and centrally planned economies, which was quite mathematical at the time. And then from there, got a job in the capital markets section of the Federal Reserve Board in Washington, D.C.
May I ask who you did your PhD under?
I did my PhD under Dwight Jaffe, Richard Quant, and William Branson.
Okay. I have some contacts in the history of economics community, so I was trying to work out
Well, there were some people very much involved with it at the time.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Well, we won't get too distracted by that. So let's talk about then going into your career.
Well, in getting into munis, as I think a lot of people, particularly reporters and other people who get involved in the municipal bond market, find themselves sort of doing it by the back door and ending up there for the rest of their lives. In my case, when I was at the Fed, I was working in the savings and loan area. I hadn't had time to write any articles off my dissertation. My boss wanted to see that kind of thing. The Fed was encouraging it. And I became aware that they had a position in the capital markets section that hadn't been filled for 3 years. That position was state and local finance, which was supposed to be covering the municipal bond market. They hadn't filled it for 3 years. There was a good chance they were going to lose it in the next budget cycle because the bosses sit there and say, we haven't filled it for 3 years. We're going to take it away. So I made a deal with my boss. I said, listen, I'll take that job and I'll spend 50% of my time writing articles off my dissertation, the other 50% worrying about the state and local bond market. And the day that I got my papers that said you're no longer a savings and loan, non-bank financial institutions, it covered a lot of stuff besides savings and loan. When I moved over to that area formally was the day the last bond deal done by the city of New York broke syndicate, which meant that it was no longer subject to price restrictions, and it dropped 10%, which precipitated the whole New York City financial crisis.
Okay, so you got your PhD in 74.
Right, a year after I had joined the Fed. I finished up the doctorate and submitted the dissertation.
Okay. So please continue.
Okay. So anyway, I was suddenly thrust into the New York City financial crisis. And I didn't know much about the municipal bond market. I didn't know much about municipal finance at the time. And the next 2 years were a lot of fun, very exciting, real learning experience about state and local finance internally. In other words, how do cities and towns and everything, budgeting, pensions, the whole shooting match of issues which are still around today, and you can read about them in the context of Puerto Rico or the Detroit bankruptcy or the bankruptcies in California. Same issues, very similar issues related to state and local finance. Not by that, I'm using a broader term, not only the internal finances of the state and local government, but also the bond markets which they access. And so I was asked constantly to update the Board of Governors at the time, run by Arthur Burns, about what was going on in New York City. And my bosses very cleverly sent me to New York City in March 1975 with no sort of general brief and just to meet people up there. And in the course of that, one of the guys who was sort of the dealer who was at Chase Manhattan Bank at the time, he was sort of the sort of godfather, sort of the main guy for Muni Finance in New York City, took me aside at one point and said, is the Fed going to bail out New York City? And I said, that's highly unlikely. And so I then get back after this trip. I didn't think much of it at the time. I go back to D.C. after the trip. And the first question I got out of my boss is the head of the division, the head of my section, and coming from the board was, did anyone ask you about bailing out New York City? So I was tasked with writing a memo, which was kept permanently in draft form, I guess so it couldn't be subpoenaed or whatever, about how we could bail out New York City if need be, and should we. And it was an interesting, I became very much involved in New York City's financial picture, trying to figure things out. And we could probably do a history lesson solely on New York City. A couple things are sort of interesting side notes. One, in a subsequent trip, went and visited with the rating agencies, S&P and Moody's at the time. And at Moody's, talked to the sort of godfather of that organization at the time in Muni's. And I asked him, because I was writing this paper for the Fed Board of Governors, asked him at the time, and I said, how much net debt does New York City have outstanding, both long and short term? And he turned to me and he said, Kit, I'm going to show you this piece of paper, and I will deny until my death that I ever showed it to you. And it was a piece of paper, two sides, and it asked the city to fill out those numbers. The numbers had been filled out so many times and erased so many times that there was a hole, a little stripe hole in the papers, and next to it written in pencil were some numbers with a question mark. So here you have a major city in the United States, clearly with billions of dollars worth of debt outstanding, and nobody had a clue. So I actually had to go do some investigation, ask the New York Fed to get some documents from the city, which they did, shipped them down to D.C., and made the first calculation of how much short-term debt New York City had outstanding. And I'm proud to say that that estimate was very, very close to what they concluded at one point was the actual number, although I'm sure no one really knew for certain, ever. In the course of that, ended up in reporting to the Board of Governors, slowly the various layers of management above me were pulled away, and I ended up working directly with the then chairman of the Fed, Arthur Burns, on the New York City financial crisis, and writing papers for him, preparing briefing documents. And at one point, after President Nixon resigned, I was actually, he was going over and visiting with Haldeman and Ehrlichman and Gerald Ford and the whole shoot match, and trying to convince them of the nature of the depth of this crisis. And so that involvement with Burns and the city financial crisis was, you know, literally being thrown from the pan into the fire for about a year and a half. A lot of fun. As I said, I wouldn't have traded it for anything. Afterwards, I still was involved with the city because it was still being worked out. The financings were going on. And then in the fall of 1977, by then legislation had been passed. New York City got loan guarantees of its short-term debt so it could keep its financing going and the like. Then in the fall of 1977, the Treasury was looking around for someone to run that office, the Office of New York Finance. I had become acquainted with several of the people over in that office, or in that, you know, the Deputy Assistant Secretary and others, because they had been involved with the New York City financial crisis while they were in New York. They came down to work in the Treasury, and so they asked me to come over, and in effect, I was loaned to the Treasury for 6 months to run the Office of New York Finance while the original legislation was going through the renewal process in Congress. So at the end of that, I had been out of graduate school for 5 years and thought, well, did I really want to go back to the Fed? And it was going to be awfully boring after this because it was going to be sort of routine, very routine economics. And so I was wondering about what to do and where and the like. And then the job at the MSRB opened up. And a friend of mine said, why don't you apply? And so I applied for the job as executive director and became executive director in August of 1978, technically September of 1978. Came on the staff as a supernumerary. There was a 1 month overlap with my predecessor. So anyway, that's how I came to be at the MSRB in the fall of 78 and was there until June of 2007.
I wonder if I can ask you a little bit more about the New York City crisis. One of the reasons that I'm interested in is that we've actually done quite a bit of archival work in the Treasury Department papers. So we've seen some of their memoranda and that sort of thing. And so I'm wondering if you could elaborate a little bit on the roles of the Treasury versus the Federal Reserve, and also the move from the Nixon and Ford administrations into the Carter administration.
Well,
if there's anything to say about it.
Well, there's an amusing part to the story about the transition from Nixon to Ford. Because I think by the time I really got involved, Ford had already become president. If you read one of the Woodward Bernstein books, it points out that Gerald Ford was often presented with policy options in the form of multiple choice questions. And people poo-pooed that. Rumsfeld, I think, was deputy chief of staff. I mean, some of the same characters that we saw under George W. Bush were there at the time Ford came into the presidency. One day, when I was preparing and updating a briefing book for Chairman Arthur Burns, I opened up the briefing book, and there was a three-page multiple-choice outline document of what the federal government should do vis-a-vis New York City. The Fed probably could have stretched its authority to deal with New York City, but the problem really was, in the city's case, is that the city didn't want anybody overseeing them. And in our form of government, states really are the parents to the children, which is in the case is New York City in that case. New York City didn't believe it was a child. It believed it was an 18-year-old teenager and perfectly capable of making rational decisions, although they'd screwed it up for 25 years by promising excessive wage increases and very generous pensions. Problems, as I said earlier, exist today. So what the federal government wanted to have happen, and these were discussions that I had had with Burns, was, look, you got to have the state get involved. You have to have the state be an actor and take responsibility for the city. And so the workout and all of this. And then basically what happened with Hugh Carey, which I give him great, great credit for willingness to step up. And there were a number of city leaders, a number of CEOs of banks, chairmen and CEOs of banks, who stepped to the fore and said, look, what's the right thing to do? How do we work this out? And they did it. Even the head of the municipal unions did it. Believe it or not, the city pension funds, tax-exempt organizations, didn't have to pay tax or anything, ended up buying tax-exempt muni bonds, which is sort of a no-no in some ways. But they were forced to eat the bonds as part of the argument because they were a good deal of the problem. Their pensions were excessive then, probably still are to some degree. And that kind of thing, you had to have the city sort of really get its act together. And so municipal employment was knocked down by, I think, 50%. The unions and the banks bought a lot of the city debt. They had a responsibility to do it. Then the federal government said, look, we'll come in and we'll help. We'll guarantee some of the short-term debt, provided you meet certain benchmarks, one of which was that you have adequate financial data, because no one could believe that the city, this large, had no clue of how much outstanding debt it had. And so that whole financial management programs were put into the city. The Office of New York Finance at the Treasury really had the responsibility for making sure that that process took place. They hired Arthur Anderson to advise them, who was overseeing what was being done by another accounting firm. I mean, people jumped into this kind of thing, and the feds were the ones that had the hammer with the loan guarantees. The guarantees were only for 3 years. And the question was whether what happens at the end of 3 years, are you going to have sufficient progress to then go ahead and renew the guarantees for people. So I don't know whether that's answered your question or I've gotten too far afield, but that's really where the Treasury and everybody else was involved with New York City Finance. They were renewed in 78, and then they expired 3 years later. Okay. The whole legislation expired 3 years later.
How deep were the concerns at the time that that might not be an isolated case?
Oh, they were pretty. I mean, yeah. The first memo I got, the first request, after things stabilized, my involvement actually were relatively private meetings between the Board of Governors or the chairman. We were all in a room together. It was sort of very unusual for a staffer to be sort of that close to those guys without any intervening supervision. But those guys wanted to know exactly that question: who is next? And the memo I wrote was Puerto Rico. And you can pick up the papers and read about Puerto Rico today.
Yes. Okay, so now one somewhat related question, I think, and this again goes to our working in the Treasury archives, is that the Carter Treasury actually had, I don't think this went anywhere, but you might have some insight, proposals for a taxable bond option or otherwise a bondholder taxable option.
Oh, God.
Have you heard of that?
Look, the first paper when I was involved in municipal finance, before the New York City financial crisis, actually, there was the boss came to me and said, yeah, you're going to be made the state and local finance economist. We don't have the papers yet. By the way, here's a Treasury proposal to have a taxable bond option. Tell me what you think of that. So that proposal has been outstanding since the mid-60s. There were a couple of economic papers done. And Treasury in 1969 had some guy running the Office of Tax at the time, who was a big-time lawyer from, I believe, Harvard, where he sort of talked about a lot of the reforms that we're still talking about today. And the TBO was one of those.
Okay. So now I guess we can go on to the MSRB. I know very little about its earlier. So first of all, who was your predecessor as executive director?
Frieda Wallison, who okay. was an attorney, who was actually the general counsel before she became the executive director. Let's go back to 1973, 74, somewhere around there. Tail end of the Vietnam War. there were a series of scandals that developed in the municipal bond market where individuals were deprived of basically all their life savings by unscrupulous dealers. They were labeled as the Memphis bond dealers.
But bond daddies?
Bond daddies, yes. Oh, yes. Bond daddies. And it was a series of sales techniques that the people in Memphis refined. Most of those techniques actually developed further up the river in Cincinnati and then eventually came to Memphis and into Little Rock, Arkansas. Those were sort of the two hotbed areas. The story, maybe perhaps somewhat apocryphal, was that one of the dealers called up people who were Vietnam prisoners of war who were coming back with large amounts of accumulated monies. And they said to him, look, the dealer wrote to him and said, listen, I was a prisoner of war in Korea. When I came back, an unscrupulous muni dealer ripped me off and I lost my whole life savings. Send me your life savings. Which, unfortunately, they did. Not the brightest thing to do. Put all your money in a check to somebody you don't really know. So they sent him to this guy, and he promptly invested it in fly-by-night muni schemes, which included catfish farms and a whole bunch of... there's a thing called fireplugs, where you can go... You used to be able to go through parts of Tennessee and just see these fireplugs along the road, which were supposedly going to provide, you know, fire services to communities. And so the bonds were to be paid off by the new communities where they're, well, these things were out in the middle of freaking nowhere. So there were congressional hearings. To the credit of the then people, some of the people that were in the industry, from some of the bigger firms and from some of the more regional firms, they said, look, we're going to get legislation. How do we do this so that both banks and broker-dealers are regulated? And they developed this and took to the Congress the scheme of the MSRB, which was a board of directors of five dealers from banks, five dealers from securities firms, because there was a separation between banks and securities firms at the time, and five public members, one of which had to be an issuer and one of which had to be a buyer. And that board was instructed to write, you know, basically a rule book. And that, it got embodied in legislation in 1975. Again, my boss at the Fed at the time, I was at Fed, walked in with this legislation and we were asked to comment on it. I said, this is never going to work. the parties are never going to get together to produce it. To the credit, from 1975 to 1978, they basically started to put together the basic rule book and deal with those issues to at least have a basis. When I came in 1978, I figured that a lot of my role was going to be refining this set of rules because no one gets it right the first time in D.C., and so that we would be sitting there doing it. Came in at a fortuitous time in some sense because bond volume at that time was about $23 billion a year. Within 5 years, it was doubled. And over the course of the time that I was at the MSRB, it went from $25 billion to $450 billion in terms of muni finance. The industry really, really grew. So that's how the MSRB came into existence. And as I said, I came in just about the time when the first basic set of rules was done. If you want me to keep rattling on.
Absolutely. I mean, Carla's instructions to us are let people talk if they want to. So
at that time, there were two, from the period of like 78 to 81, there were two rules that we put in place that I am particularly proud of and I think were critically important to the growth of the industry and and almost all the subsequent developments in terms of rulemaking done by the MSRB. The first was a requirement that CUSIP numbers be put on the bond, that bonds trade on the basis of CUSIP number. And CUSIP numbers are supposed to identify separately tradable items. You and I are both human beings, but you're Will Thomas and I'm Kit Taylor. You're wearing a tie and I'm not. And so what there really should be is a numbering system that says, okay, Will, you've got, this is who you are. You're number 1, 2, 3, and I'm number 4, 5, 6. So that if anybody wanted to trade something, they would be able to go to a central place to find a description of the bonds. It was sort of stunning to me at the time to realize there was a vast amount of trading going on, and people didn't know what the hell they were trading. And they had no basis for doing so. And so you go, oh, God. And I've always had a lifelong interest in computers. In fact, built my own first computer when I was in 1958 out of the back of Boys Life magazine. Anyway, you find out very quickly that if you're dealing with computers, you really do need precision and you need numbers. And I thought, and one of the deputy executive director with whom I was very fortunate to have on the staff at the time I arrived, and a couple of board members understood the importance of computerization for this industry. So the CUSIP numbering requirement was pushed through. There was a lot of opposition from the industry. It was not welcomed, if you will, because it required dealers then that if they bought a bond from a customer or sold a bond, to have a CUSIP number on it. Oh, my God, I had to identify what the hell I was selling. I cannot begin to tell you how important that was, because people were trading various securities which had the basic same name, but the underlying characteristics were different. They were backed by a different revenue source. They had different call features. And people were not specifying these things on the confirmation. So a customer had no clue what they were getting. In addition, our friends at the SEC had a filing system, was called Filing of Securities by Issuer. All they said to the dealers is, listen, all these pieces of paper, you got, just put them in a bin that says who the issuer is. Well, the issuer might have had 5, 6, 7, 8 different kinds of securities issued by the same issuer. And in fact, the best example of that was the bonds of the Washington Public Power Supply System. 3 issues of those were guaranteed by the feds, 2 issues were not. But if you went into the vaults, and I did go into the vaults and see those of one of the largest dealers at the time, it was what looked like a laundry bin, and the stuff was together, and it, you know, you could see series 1, 2, 3 here, guaranteed by the feds, series 4, 5 over here, not guaranteed by the feds, all mixed together.
Where is this vault?
Was in the basement of a very large securities dealer in New York City, who will remain unnamed. And those dealers, once the CUSIP numbering requirement was there, and once the SEC got through its head, that, oh my God, an issuer in bonds can have different types of securities. Outstanding. They said, okay, you have to break the box, meaning you have to break up that clothes basket of Washington Public Power Supply System bonds into 1s and 2s and 3s and 4s and 5s, and you had to assign to customers, okay, you own 4s and 5s, which are not guaranteed. I own 1, 2, 3s that were. What was sold to whom and everything. So it was a huge accounting behind the scenes thing. To the credit of this dealer, they had sufficient records that they could say Will owned the 4s and 5s and Kit owned the 1, 2, 3s. And they were able to successfully break the box without it causing someone to end up with something that was not nearly worth what they thought it was. But that was a critical element to the whole thing, which brings me actually to sort of a thing that I became aware of at that time, sort of was driven home, which was that the SEC itself had very little experience, none basically, with fixed income securities. None of their rules regulated any of the fixed income securities markets, including corporate bonds. I mean, there's just no clue whatsoever. And so the second rule that I really take a lot of pride in was placing a yield to maturity on the confirmation. Each confirmation to a customer had to have the yield to maturity. You know, economists can argue about whether yield to maturity is a proper measure. But the fact is, markets traded on yield to maturity. People compared bonds based on yield to maturity. There's also yield to call and things like this. But it was basically putting a calculated yield that everyone could agree to the calculation on the confirmation so people could compare what they were getting and what the yields were. And let's face it, you go to CNN, you go to CNBC today, you turn it on, the ticker at the top says three-year treasuries, five-year treasuries, 10-year, yield this way. That concept really wasn't there in 1980. And the SEC didn't understand it. We put the requirement in, and I had the SEC staffer who was responsible for dealing with us come over and accusing me of perpetrating a fraud, because the calculation of yield to maturity says you reinvest the bond interest rate at the same rate as the yield to maturity. It's a, in that sense, it's an artificial kind of calculation. And I had to explain as nicely as I could that that's the basis on which everyone traded, and that's the basis that economists used, everyone used. It was the basic language. Those two developments actually, you know, from that point on through most of the 80s, what the MSRB was doing ended up getting copied over into the corporate market, get copied over into the treasury market, because we had responsibility to do it. The SEC sort of passively followed along and said, okay, if the MSRB is going to do this for munis, you got to do this for corporates, you got to do this for treasuries, kind of thing. To a much lesser extent with treasuries, because it was the federal government. But that also allowed, as I said, the computerization of the industry and the ability to compare products. And those two things are the fundamental backbones of any market structure, which is where I come from as a doctorate in economics and a person who studied markets, that's the basis for an efficient market. You have to be able to compare the products. And I would say you can almost look at the great bulk of regular rules other than those that deal with political contributions and the like and corruption. That the basis of virtually everything I did during my tenure and beyond, even today, is providing sufficient information to the customer to be able to know what they're buying and being able to compare that product, which is the basic functioning of a market. I often drew the thing, people would say, well, why are you putting this rule into effect or that rule into effect? And I said, listen, dealing in munis, and what we've tried to do is go from walking into a supermarket and seeing 1,000 brown bags with hardly any label on them. And in fact, not having, I mean, think back. You used to go to a grocery store, you didn't even get all of the stuff about, you know, what's in the product. So we have moved to going from a brown bag that you could barely tell what the name of the thing it is you were buying to a brown bag with a name on it, a barcode on it, and nutrition information on it. And that's been the whole basis for much of the rulemaking that we've done. I sort of viewed it as my, people say, well, you know, they come to me and they say, look, kid, you got a doctorate in economics and you're not practicing economics. I said, no, I am practicing economics every day trying to make a market efficient. And whether it's providing for the collection of official statements, gee, basic nutrition information, what the hell's in the bond? Pricing, price reporting that took place in the 90s. These were two developments that took place in the 90s. I said, so you walk in, you got your brown bag. Now you know, you can find out what the ingredients were in the product. You might not know about its freshness date, but at least you can get the basic ingredients. And, oh, wouldn't you like to know the price that was paid for that yesterday or 15, 20 minutes ago? Yes, you would. We all do. So it allowed comparison shopping.
It's the basis of what makes economic behavior possible, basically, is what you're saying.
Well, markets presume, I mean, and it's kind of funny, I have to laugh at a lot of people on the street who kept throwing Adam Smith at me and sort of like, you know, free markets and all this, that if you actually go and you look at the economics behind a free market, you have to have centralized information about what you're buying and selling. You have to know. Adam Smith talks about it. He talks about knowing what the description of the product is. He hated dealer markets. He wanted markets centralized so people could price compare. And those kinds of things that and then all the mathematical economics and stuff that I studied in graduate school and in undergraduate school, the whole basis of economics is, the proving that the free market, the competitive market model is the most efficient market, presumes those things as assumptions that these, you know what you're selling and you know what the price is and you can see those prices.
Are we talking basically about general equilibrium here now?
Yeah, equilibrium, reaching a general equilibrium solution that's efficient presumes that. And so I'm sitting there thinking, yeah, I'm practicing it every day because I started with something that was so far away from that. There were those in the dealer community that thought that, who were progressive enough to realize what this does is lead to an expansion of the market. There were those in the industry who loved their little temporal or informational monopolies. They were the only ones that knew about it, and so they didn't need to share that or want to share that because it would reduce their profit. Adam Smith says, yeah, if you have a monopoly of some of this information necessary for an efficient market, you're going to make it about above normal profits. And there are many people that argue that that's precisely why Wall Street makes so much money today. It's these temporal or informational monopolies that they enjoy.
I want to ask you a little bit about the legislative basis for the MSRB, because, of course, that's from the 1975 Securities Act amendments. But I know that there was some fluidity and some expectation of further legislation for at least a couple of years after that. I know that Senator Harrison Williams...
Oh, they did their usual oversight hearings. Yeah. You know, like, are you doing your job? If you're not going to do your job, I'm going to, impose these things. Harrison Williams' stuff had really little to do directly with the MSRB. The MSRB wrote rules for dealers, mm-hmm. but not for issuers. Harrison Williams' legislation was really geared, and by the way, the 75 legislation exempted and prohibited the MSRB from really getting at issuers and telling them what to do. Harrison Williams' legislation was really designed to control issuers, to make them produce audited financial reports, to go again to that product description and nutrition mm-hmm. information and freshness date. And those arguments, unfortunately, are still very vibrant even today. Progress has been made, but boy, it is sure slow.
And, you alluded to the Teller Amendment. What was kind of the impression? The impression of that at the time. Was that considered to be a good solution to
The dealers in effect, hated it because they knew that what part of the problem was that, you know, it's the issuer and the underwriter getting together to bring something to the market to sell, but the issuer is saying, I don't have to tell the market what the hell's there. In some sense, it was brought home in the New York City. There was finally a report on the New York City financial crisis issued, I think, in 1987 by John Dingell. And in that report, that was actually the Whoops report. The New York City report came earlier in the early part of the 80s. If you look at that, you see Abe Beame saying, I'm not going to tell you what the city's finances are. Your job is to go out and sell the securities, which was basically saying, I don't care what you have to tell the consumer. Get them to buy. And that's antithetical to so many things we know about fairness. Well, there were a lot of people in the dealer community that said, hey, wait a minute. You know, don't lay the responsibility on us. Put some responsibility on the issuer to tell them. To tell the world what their status is. And again, that arguments, some of those arguments are still extant today with what we've seen in the pressures and stresses in the state and local sector.
And of course, we'll get to 15C212 a little bit later. In the interim, maybe I can ask about some of the other players. Some of whom were also quite new. There was the Public Securities Association, National Association of Bond Lawyers. Your relations with those?
Well, let's start with the Public Securities Association. Bear in mind, again, the MSRB had people regulated by the Fed. The MSRB was unique, in a way, as a Washington institution, in that we were private in terms of salaries, budget, the whole shooting match. All that had to happen was we had to report to the SEC whatever rules we wrote, and the SEC put their stamp of approval on it, made in effect a federal law. So here we were, a private body writing federal law that was it could be enforced against banks and securities firms. So the securities firms wasn't much a big deal. But in the banking case, you already had three federal regulators, and they were charged with enforcing MSRB rules. The NASD was, at the time, FINRA's predecessor, was required to enforce rules for the securities dealers around the country. But see, on the board, you had both dealer banks and securities firms. They'd always worked together in the muni sector. They worked together in the treasury sector. And so, because banks were allowed to be in treasuries and munis even after Glass-Steagall. So the PSA was formed as a way of bringing banks and securities firms together to talk about the fixed income markets and witness its name, public securities, munis, treasuries. It included Fannie and Freddie's at the same time, you know, government-backed agencies. That became the PSA because they wanted to expand into corporates, mortgage backs, and other securities, which they did subsequently. We had the usual tension with them because here we are writing rules. The fundamental reaction of anybody subject to rulemaking is, no, I don't want any rules. So I fully expected to have, you know, they were constant opposition, if you will. I often felt that the MSRB board, certainly for the first 20 years or so, was at the center of a lot of competing tension between the dealers and the banks, between the board, the PSA, the bond lawyers, which were representing issuer interest to some extent. The municipal, there were lots of issuer organizations. They were pulling on us, saying don't do anything because of Tower. The dealers are telling us not to do anything. You had the bank regulators saying we don't like these rules. The SEC having to. So we were constantly being pulled and pushed. And as an economist, that's what makes markets. So I sort of viewed in some ways that this was a good rulemaking process.
The push and the pull is...
The push and the pull. I think it broke down as we got into the new millennium, but that's another story.
Okay. Could you tell me a little bit about what the role of the executive director yourself was versus the board?
I ran the staff. A board basically... But here was a part-time board from the industry. It wasn't their job to sit down. Their day-to-day stuff was trading, buying, selling. And the legislation is pretty clear that they were to bring their expertise to the table. So from the very earliest days, the staff basically was saying, here's where we think we ought to go. We think we see this. You guys have talked at the board table about this problem or that problem. How do we solve it? This is the staff's proposed solutions. Here are two or three solutions. You know, my role was to sort of hear the board, if you will, and direct the staff accordingly. And vice versa, to hear what was coming out of the staff stuff and try to communicate it to the board. I once said, well, you know, regulation and the self-regulation, which is what we were supposed to be, is like trying to sell, you know, refrigerators to Eskimos. You're trying to sell something to people who don't generally want it. And you have to convince them that it's in their best long-run interest. And long-run interest is not something that is readily apparent to a lot of people.
Now, the MSRB was the first SRO by many years to have public members.
Yes.
I don't know if you can comment.
Well, we actually had the first female SRO member even before the New York Stock Exchange. We had the first female chairman before any of the other SROs. In that sense, it was very progressive. The muni sector has always been the most diverse part of the securities industry. And if you go into Goldman Sachs today or J.P. Morgan, I will wager that the most diverse department is still the muni departments. It is. The public member involvement was, at least for a very, very long period of time, not much different than the dealer involvement. These were part-time people who were brought on board with the idea that their expertise would be brought to bear, and that the tension between the relative groups represented on the board would result in an appropriate rule. Yield to maturity. Literally, I had two board members standing across from each other at the table, yelling at each other and threatening physical violence. So I learned very quickly that... people's passions were there, as they should be. I don't think that the involvement of public members was... I think it was good in some ways. I think it was overemphasized, and particularly later on, because as you get into the 90s and into the first decade of the millennium, you really ended up with a situation where the issuers were getting close to driving the truck. And it was all an outcome of the 1986 legislation, tax reform then, because it changed where dealers made money within their own operations. And it changed it to a market where public finance and underwriting the bonds was a big deal. Well, what that does, in effect, is make the dealers sort of suck up to the issuers. So then the question is, do you have a balance between the issuers and the issuers and the dealers? Do you have that tension there? And I saw that sort of diminish over time. But public members, look, if you're going to do it, you need to hear, and you need to keep your ears open to all the different constituencies out there. So I didn't view it as, it was special, and we were different. We were an example that it can work. Industry can work with government. It doesn't have to be either or. It doesn't have to be, you know, violent antagonism out of the whole thing. And we were touted as an example in numerous congressional hearings of, okay, yeah, this can work. Why don't we try it here? Why don't we try it there? That sort of thing.
I know in the late 1970s, going into the 1980s, industrial development bonds were becoming a contentious issue because there were a lot more of them, and eventually,
well, it wasn't
the 86 Act.
Even before the creation of the MSRB, those bonds were sort of looked at as sort of on the edge in terms of tax-exempt use. And whether or not it was an abuse of the tax code to do industrial development bonds, because you're conferring tax exemption, which is a cost to the federal government. You know, because if they were issued in taxable form, the government would make more revenue. Tax exemption was viewed as being a positive benefit. And why was the government allowing certain states who were very liberal in how they wrote industrial development bond legislation and certain dealers to benefit from this? And some very egregious deals got done where there was very little public purpose. And by the time of the 86 Tax Act, you had people doing deals where there was no expectation whatsoever that any facility would ever be built. That it was solely for issuing bonds that were tax exempt, and after 3 years they'd be called and they'd go away. But meanwhile, investors would get the tax exemption, issuers might get a little bit of benefit. The dealers certainly got a hell of a lot of benefit. They were underwriting the bonds. And so it was a thing that was viewed as a ripoff of the government, which then led to the 86 Tax Act, which said, okay, here are some of the things you can and cannot do. First of all, banks will not be allowed, except in very limited circumstances, to buy munis, because they were allowed to deduct. Banks were able to buy munis and deduct the cost of buying the munis, essentially the financing cost of buying the munis. Then they were getting tax-exempt income, and they were paying 50% rate. It was a hell of a deal for banks. I mean, property casualty insurance companies, somewhat similar but not quite as pronounced benefit to them. And so the 86 Tax Act also eliminated tax shelters. So suddenly the only tax-advantaged investment after 86 were munis. The dealer community got restructured because a lot of dealers had trading between small banks, large banks, property casualty insurance companies. There was a lot of secondary market trading amongst big professionals. That essentially got blown out of the water because these guys couldn't buy it anymore. I mean, dealer shops went out of business because their whole thing was based on selling to small banks and regional banks. Gone. So what you were left with was selling to retail and underwriting the bonds. And that was a fundamental change in the structure of the market. And to the credit of the board at that time, there were two chairmen, John Rowe and Jimmy Hardy. Those two guys got it. And that's when we pushed the SEC to allow us to collect official statements, which was supposedly a public document, is a public document. Bond lawyers thought it wasn't, by the way. Some of them didn't. And there was violent opposition from the issuer community. It was as strong opposition as anything in the MSRB's history, in my judgment, even over our limitations on political contributions.
We're around 1990 now?
Yeah, we're right around 1990.
The missile system?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. And the idea was, we'll collect the OSs because that's going to give you the... Again, the packaging, it's going to tell you what's in the product, and it's going to give you a snapshot of the financial condition. I mean, I was stunned at the opposite. This is a public document, and we were proposing to collect it, and at our cost, store it. And the issuer community thought this was like the world's worst thing. The world was going to come to an end. And I said, this is a public document. How can you argue against the collection of a public document? Well, I guess I had an inkling when a bond lawyer came up to me in a meeting and said, "Kit, you know you're going to destroy things." And I said, "What do you mean?" And he said, "Look, if we distribute the bond document, if people have access to it, then we have to abide by the covenants in the document. We have to abide by what's written in the document. We can't change it." And I looked at him and I was almost in shock. I said, "So you change the covenants after the deal is done, but without the bondholder's knowledge?" "Oh yeah, we do it all the time." All right. Yeah, you're laughing.
Yeah.
You're laughing, but this is 1990.
Uh-huh.
The size of the market was 1.5 million different securities and over $2.5 trillion outstanding. And we're talking about this. And I'm going, this is crazy. It took us 3 years and a lot of hard work from staff and others to put that in place. And we came out of that battle and unfortunately went right into the political contributions battle.
All right. Okay, I think I'll bring us back
sure.
a little bit, way back to the report on pricing.
Okay, the report on pricing was basically an idea of sitting there saying, listen, you have to know, again, it goes back to the fundamentals of markets. You have to know what the price is. And we wanted to get out there that there was a wide range of the prices and the markups that people were attaching to bonds, and we were trying. This was pricing report was 1980-81. I actually tell me if I've got it wrong. It's
You've
been a
had
while.
The timeline, I think.
Yeah, the report of pricing. I don't. In the grand scheme of things, it wasn't as big a deal. What it was saying, listen, the acceptable range of markups are sort of what the margins that dealers can make on bonds should generally be here and here. The SEC had wanted us, and the reason that was written was because the SEC wanted us to write a rule that the confirmation that went to the customer would show the dealer's gross profit. And there are almost no industries that I know of that today, even, where you get to know exactly what the dealer made on your purchase. But the SEC wanted us to do this because they thought there was abuse in the area. So we wrote the report in pricing and said, well, it shouldn't be more than this or that. You know, we gave a range. But way down the road, the SEC came back to the idea of this gross profit, and we said, okay, the only way to really address this that's fair is do price reporting, which is, again, go back to Adam Smith. You know, go to the market and see what the prices are that things were bought and sold. And if you look at trading patterns in munis, you see that a new issue comes to market. There's a lot of trading in the new issue. 6 months out, there's almost no trading in it. You could go 5 years, and then all of a sudden the product comes up. Nobody's traded it. How do you know what it's worth? Well, you have to hope you got nutrition information and product description. But the other thing you want to know is, well, that one was similar to this one. What did this one trade for? And maybe this one is trading today, so I get a better idea of what this one's trading for. So that was the basis for price reporting, and we started the effort to produce more and more price information, which resulted finally in 2005 with 15-minute reporting of prices. So you go back all the way. Again, it goes back to those things that very early in my tenure where I looked at it and said, if you want to have a market, these are the factors you got to have, and one of them is pricing.
Okay, just picking up a few other pieces. So, of course, there was the Tax Equity and Fiscal Responsibility Act that finally...
86 Tax Act, essentially. TEFRA.
Right. 82, no?
Yeah, 82 was TEFRA.
Right.
That didn't really affect us at all.
Okay.
86 did.
Yeah. Why don't we talk about 86 then? You've already mentioned it, I guess.
Right.
So if you have more to say...
No, it restructured the market. It did... it did, A, it changed our internal focus, that if you're going to sell to retail, you better give them the same information again in equities. But on the flip side, it also said the only way underwriters can make money is underwriting bonds and doing them on a negotiated basis. So this means issuers, I mean, dealers walk into an issuer, will go into Rockville and say, okay, Rockville, you're going to issue $50 million worth of bonds for new parkland and libraries. You should use us. And, you know, we'll get the management fee and we'll underwrite the bonds and we'll work for you. As opposed to a competitive sale where Rockville says, okay, we're going to sell $50 million on XYZ date. You know, everybody put in their bids on that day. So negotiated sale, the dealers are competing on who's their best friend with the issuer kind of thing. And supposedly on their expertise. Well, some of the dealers figured out pretty early on that they had to ingratiate themselves with the issuer. And the best way to ingratiate yourself with an issuer at the time was to make political contributions. And by 1983, we were talking about big numbers where issuers would walk in, treasurer of a state would walk into a dealer floor and say, I need to walk out of here with $50,000 worth of contributions. Tell your traders, public finance people to open up their checkbooks. I mean, that makes it look like the issuer was, you know, encouraging graft or whatever you want to call it. But by the same token, dealers were doing the same thing. It was a mutual ugliness where, you know, in certain cases, one party was pushing and the other was not. And it reached a point where it affected the 1993 municipal election, New York City city finance director election. I mean, the woman was running, I forget what her name, Elizabeth, it wasn't Holtzman. Anyway, she was running for treasurer. And she'd come out of Fleet Bank, and they gave her like $250,000. I gave her a big number in terms of political contributions. She turned around and gave him a deal. And she was running for re-election. Anyway, it was in the newspapers, and I could smell that. I mean, it had been talked about at the board that political contributions were a problem. Her dealer is sitting there saying, this is getting out of hand. We ought to do something about it. And then this thing breaks in New York City, and it doesn't, if you're in Washington long enough, you know when it's going to come home to bite you and when you're going to get congressional hearings. And by the end of the summer, we knew we were going to be up in front of Congress. Dingell was talking about it, and we had gone out and hired Harvey Pitt to do a paper for us on what we could do. And to the board's credit, in an August 1993 meeting, they basically said, we're going to ban them. And we'll take the hit, see what happens with it. And we did. Arthur Levitt, who was chairman of the SEC, didn't think that it would withstand constitutional scrutiny, court scrutiny, and thus far it has. And I think it will continue to hold.
And part of the reason that it's a ceiling of contribution rather than a ban.
It basically says if you give money, we're not stopping you, but if you're a dealer and when a personnel involved and you give to an issuer, you may not do negotiated business with that issuer. You can do competitive bid business. You don't have to do business with them. You want to give to the governor of California's race, that's fine, but you cannot then underwrite his bonds for the state of California on a negotiated basis. Okay? You can't ingratiate yourself, dealer. You can vote. You can give up to 200, I think the limit's 250 bucks for somebody who lives in your neck of the woods. You know, you live in Westchester County, New York. You can give money to state senator, to the governor, because that's your constitutional right to be able to give. Now, we did put a limit on it. So again, it wasn't going to be the real or announced perception of abuse. We got sued by a fellow named William Blunt, Mr. Blunt failed at the Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia, and the Supreme Court denied certiorari, which meant that the appeals court decision stood. Interestingly enough, Mr. Blunt went to prison for 20 years for essentially bribing the mayor of Jefferson County, Alabama, which...
This is much later, of course.
Yes.
Yeah.
This was in 2010. He goes to jail for a very long period of time for having bribed a guy. He was outraged that he couldn't give money to his local friends. Anyway.
And then there was some question about whether or not the rule would be enforceable. I remember we were looking through the response letters, and there was one that was directed, I think, to you, saying you must believe in the Easter Bunny if you think this.
Oh God, yeah. The odd part about it is there were two aspects to the rule that are still very unique. One, the penalty is built into the rule. It is amazing that the dealer community at the time, and that some bright lawyers did figure it out. They said, look, this is a problem. Because up to now, and even today, the larger securities firms and people love to hire this band of lawyers, go down to the SEC and say, you shouldn't charge us. You know, we will neither admit nor be guilt nor deny that we did these things, but, you know, we'll enter into a consent decree. But we'll argue with you about what was in the thing and what the penalty should be. We should be able to argue with you. This rule said, if you do it, 2 years, you're out of the box for 2 years. No ifs, ands, or buts. You can appeal to the NESD, but you're out of the box for 2 years. So in the rule itself was the penalty, which some lawyers were really upset with because they couldn't deal with a weasel around if one of their clients screwed up. So you end up with what that was one aspect of the thing. The other aspect, which is, as I pointed out to the guy who called me in the Easter Bunny, you guys will rat each other out in a heartbeat. And we had reporting. So the dealers, the heads of the department lived in fear that one of their underlings would stupidly violate the rule and then they would be banned from dealing with an issuer. There were a couple very high-profile ones. The William Weld, who was running for, I think, the U.S. Senate at that time, came down in New York City, hosted a dinner with some of his buddies there. The host of the dinner said, open up your checkbooks, everybody. They wrote checks to this guy. And the idiot who wrote the check, didn't think the rules applied to him. And yet they did. And so the gentleman from Morgan Stanley got Morgan Stanley banned for 2 years from this doing negotiated deals. And they were one of the big underwriters in Massachusetts. It was very, very costly to the business. Mm.
And I've heard from a couple of people that once the rule was finally actually in place, so it actually became fairly well accepted, the people in the broker-dealers were relieved that they no longer had to open up their checkbooks.
Oh, heck, I got a call at Christmas time from a dealer at bonus time, and he said, it was a friend of mine, and he said, kid, I just want to thank you for this Christmas present. He said, I am tens of thousands of dollars richer because I don't have to make these contributions. Now, the flip side is that a lot of dealers figured out a way around it, which was to hire political consultants and an intermediary to do the same thing that they were prohibited from doing. And to make a long story short, we ended up having to ban those in 2006. Very acrimonious debate, both within the board and without the board. And I dare say there were a lot of people pissed off with me at that point.
That's G38, of course.
Yes. Yeah. It, G38 in its current form. Hmm. Excuse me for a minute. I'll look at that.
No worries.
Time.
Okay.
So where were we? G38 in its current form says you cannot hire consultants. There's actually a pretty good, regulatory economic argument from that. In the simple sense that why should a dealer be able to hire someone who is not subject to the professional qualifications rules and knowledge that that the industry requires? I mean, MSRB has professional qualifications rules that people have to pass tests in order to enter the industry. It was actually one of the requirements Congress put in 75 because the argument was too many used car salesmen were going into the industry without a clue about what a bond was, but they could sell. They could really sell. So we had to put in professional qualification standards. So when you realize, and dealers are subject to whole sets of rules other than MSRB rules. So why should a dealer be able to hire somebody outside that regulatory environment to go out and do the same business that he's doing, which is to go solicit a deal from an issuer? And to me, as an economist anyway, that's a pretty strong argument. I mean, you sit there and say either you're in, you're out, but you can't get around the whole basis of rulemaking by hiring somebody else to do your job for you. And, the problem was actually that political contributions were being made right and left by the people that were posing as consultants. I mean, it was big, big business. And to be honest, both the Republican National Committee and the Democratic National Committee had people who knew how to get around these rules. And some of those committee men and women were involved as consultants on both sides doing this, getting contributions. The stuff was being, the monies effectively were being washed through these national committees. Probably still are to some extent if you can figure out how it's done.
Mm-hmm. If I can go back and ask about the writing of G37, how difficult was it to get the terms right?
Once you come up with the basic idea that you are going to ban underwriting for negotiated deals, you know, you're going to get into argument. What's a negotiated deal? I didn't think it was that difficult to come up with the terms, quite frankly. And it was relatively short. Yes, we had to issue Q&As. What happens in this situation? What happens in that situation? It was like what we see now on the websites, FAQs, frequently asked questions. We put those out as a way of saying people have called us up with these. A lot of those questions we didn't think were that difficult. If simple reading of the rule would have told you what the answer was. The terms, I don't think the terms were that confusing or that difficult to write in terms of rulemaking. There are other rules that we did over the years which I thought were far more difficult because of the structure of how the bonds were coming to market. A lot of it had to do with clearance and settlement. A lot of it had to do with trading. Even some of the pricing stuff was far more technically difficult. G37, I don't view what we did there as being particularly difficult. The industry, the bond lawyers and others outside, from the external point of view, I can see them sitting there going, oh my God, you know, because it was a death rule. I mean, it the sword of Damocles stood over somebody who screwed up for the first time for these guys. You know, they couldn't go screaming to their in-house general counsel and say, go down to the SEC and convince them that we're not bad guys. Enter into an agreement. No, the sword came down if you screwed up. So, and there was tension around a couple of things as to how high up you go and stuff like this. But I have to say the board was pretty resolute about throughout this, even with a lot of change. And there were dealers on the board who wanted to get rid of the rule. My general counsel was actually came in on a conversation amongst board members. It was a conference call. She got put on the phone and they kept yakking. Like, you know, when are you going to get rid of Taylor? You were going to get rid of Taylor and the rule, you know? people were angry. So from an external point of view, I wouldn't be at all surprised that people were would tell you, gee, it was a long time till they got it right. It wasn't that long.
Okay, so since we're not planning to do a second session, I think I'll probably save 15C212 and the run-up to that for the beginning of our next session. But if I can go back into the 80s for something that will probably be a bit more succinct, how about the escrow to maturity controversy?
Well, that actually is the basis for 15C212.
Ah, okay.
Because if you go to escrow to maturity, what it was, again, is that some very clever dealers had said, oh, you know, this ain't nailed down. Let's go change things after the fact. And there were dealers that thought the stuff was escrowed to maturity, and some dealers say, nah, it's only escrowed to call. Again, it goes to the whole question of what's trading in the market? What does the product look like? What's the product's description? And that just heightened the board. The board had already started dealing with the whole question of we need an adequate description. We had the CUSIP descriptions. And there was a lot of complaining within the board about the quality of what CUSIP was putting on their descriptions. There was a lot of questions in the industry because, again, we put the rule in about CUSIP numbers around 1980, 79, 80. And within 5 years, we're trying to do automated clearance and settlement. It meant dealers had to be very precise about things. So there were a lot of people in the dealer community going, wait a minute, we don't have a good source of the description. And we had bond lawyers on the board. We had bond lawyers said, look, the only true description is in the official statement. And the escrow to maturity thing also said a subsequent event can change the nature of the securities, and that needs to be centrally located so everyone in the market knows that that characteristic of the security is gone or changed, and it's changed permanently. I think the escrow to maturity thing, I think it was a great driver, if you will, to the changes in 15C212. Do I think what the dealers did was right? No, I didn't. You know, the changing of the things, not at all correct. And there were dealers on the board who thought, and we privately communicated to the SEC, that this is something that board members certainly thought was closely akin to fraud. So, escrow to maturity, just another one of those events where it was, we'd already, because of what was coming out of the Washington Public Power Supply System.
Yeah, that was the angle that I thought we'd go into, 15C212.
You had sort of three things happening in the late 80s. One, you had the 86 Tax Act, okay, changed the structure of the market, putting an emphasis on underwriting and retail sales. Mm-hmm. The board comes out of that and says, we need good descriptions. We had just gone through the automation of the sort of back offices. That was saying, we need better descriptions. You have the escrow to maturity thing coming in as another factor in that thing. We need better descriptions of the security. And is at that point where we could all agree, everyone, the only legal description is in the offering document, the official statement.
Okay, well, should we
let's conclude there?